From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is Talk of the Nation. Author Anne Rice reserves the right to use any tool to unnerve you.
The world of fantasy and the world of fiction has got to be free. You know, it has to be wide open. We have to be able to deal with God, the devil, vampires, witches, everything in that realm. We have to. That's the realm where we work it all out symbolically.
Dreams and blood and pain and fear all take on new roles for the adult once the reality of decay and death, mortality and loss become more real than they are for most children. So while Power Rangers and popular TV characters will demand candy from you tomorrow, America's grown-ups are stocking their shelves with a fiction of a more satisfying, if distressing, kind. Anne Rice and Donna Tartt talk of the Nation after this news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A military cargo plane is preparing to land at Mitchell International Airport in Milwaukee. The C-130 Hercules has been circling over nearby Lake Michigan for the last few hours because its landing gear has jammed. Marge Pitroff of member station WUWM reports.
Mitchell International Airport in Milwaukee has been swarming with emergency vehicles the past couple hours, and thousands of cars have pulled over on nearby roadways to watch what happens. All the commotion began about mid-morning when the crew of a military cargo plane reported its landing gear had jammed and it could not land. The plane had been on a routine training mission leaving earlier today from Milwaukee. The crew of nine has now reportedly lowered the landing equipment by hand and is chaining it into place so it is secure. Meanwhile, dozens of fire trucks and foam trucks are lining the runway in case there is an accident. This past April, three U.S. Air Force reservists from that same 440th Airlift Wing based in Milwaukee were killed during an attempted landing in Honduras. For National Public Radio News, I'm Marge Pitroff in Milwaukee.
The stock market has recovered much of its heavy loss today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 100 points when trading opened this morning, but it recovered much of the loss and has been in positive territory occasionally. Currently, the Dow's off nearly 21 points. The White House is warning Iraq to take back its ban on American weapons inspectors or face consequences. Spokesman Mike McCurry says the United States will make sure that Iraq complies with the United Nations instructions. Yesterday, the UN Security Council warned Baghdad of serious consequences if it does not withdraw its order expelling all Americans from a UN weapons inspection team. The team has been following Iraqi weapons in the wake of the Gulf War. This year's decision by Congress to restore many welfare benefits to legal immigrants will cost the Treasury nearly $19 billion over the next 10 years. That estimate comes in a report released today by an anti-immigration group. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Roughly a year after welfare reform was signed into law, Congress backtracked on what were widely seen as the harshest cuts, disability payments to elderly and disabled legal immigrants. Rice University professor Donald Huddle says that decision will cost taxpayers $18.8 billion over the next decade. Huddle also weighs in on the question of whether immigrants are a net benefit or a cost to the U.S. By his calculations, the net cost of immigration will reach $68 billion this year. Other studies weighing the benefits brought by legal immigrants, the taxes they pay, the jobs they create, reach the opposite conclusion. A federal task force studying the question decided that, on balance, legal immigrants are a net benefit to the economy. Huddle's study was promoted by the Carrying Capacity Network, which seeks to restrict legal immigration levels. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow again is down nearly 21 points at 7,485. Trading is very heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, China has signed an agreement to buy 50 new jets from Boeing. The deal's worth $3 billion. NPR's Kathleen Schalk reports.
Currently, China's exports to the U.S. are worth six times as much as U.S. exports to China, and American officials see sales of aircraft and other high-tech big-ticket items as one way to narrow this trade deficit. The sale was timed to coincide with the summit between President Clinton and Chinese President Jiang Zemin, and Clinton hailed it as the largest sale of airplanes to China in history.
This contract will support tens of thousands of American jobs and provide China with a modern fleet of passenger planes.
The U.S. government estimates that China will spend more than $100 billion on aerospace goods and services in the next two decades and hopes much of that money will flow to the U.S. Kathleen Schalk, NPR News, Washington.
The government reports one measure of the jobless rate has fallen. The Labor Department says the number of new claims for jobless benefits dropped by 16,000 last week to the lowest level in 3 months. Many analysts were not expecting the large decline. The Salvation Army is making it easier for prospective donors to give money to the charity. It's now possible to use a credit card. The charity tested the credit card option during the holidays last year, and the program is now going national. The standard red kettles will now be linked to a credit card reading device. Donors can slide cards through a magnetic reader, punch in numbers to make a contribution, and receive a receipt. The kettles will accept American Express, MasterCard, and Visa. Again on Wall Street, the Dow's off 21 points at 7,485. The NASDAQ is down 12 at 1590. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-773.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. Children around the country spent this week worrying about their school parties. Many are getting ready to step out to ring doorbells in costumes that try to straddle fun and a fun kind of scared. When I stroll through the streets of Washington, a few paces behind my costumed children tomorrow night, I'll see streets filled with children taking far more delight in simply being something they're not for the evening than worrying about scaring the people they meet or creeping them out. It is America's teens and adults who are indulging a taste for the really uncomfortable, taking disturbing night walks through the poorly lit attics of their own heads. Teenagers flock to movies like Scream, Friday the 13th, Halloween. Adults take delight in books that make them squirm, either with graphic images that play against the screen behind their own eyes, or that work merely by suggestion, evoking a world beyond what they're able to see with their own eyes. It's a delicious discomfort, one readers pay to inflict again and again, and it seems they want a big jolt, and a bigger jolt this time than they got the last. We'll talk about the gothic novel, the literary horror genre, with two leading practitioners, Anne Rice, author of Violin, Interview with the Vampire Lestat, and others. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm
wonderful
okay.
To be back.
Good to talk to you again. And Donna Tartt is with us, author of The Secret History. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Hello.
Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Well, you've both got books out that are likely going to find their way into a lot of readers' hands. Anne Rice, Violin, is just coming out. Donna Tartt, I'm told that The Secret History is one that readers of that genre are searching out avidly and has done very well already. Why don't you tell us what it's about?
It's funny. It's not really, it's not a gothic in the traditional sense of the word. I think a lot of books get called gothic now because that aren't really. There's a whole school of sort of American gothic and this. And what that basically means is that there's a deformed character in it, or there's something unusual in it. Gothic has come to mean unusual and instead of what it really is. I mean, a novel of the supernatural. I mean, because my novel is not really a novel of the supernatural. It has some of the... It deals with some of the questions that gothics deal with, which is, you know, sort of the Byronic sort of struggle, you know, between good and evil in a particular character.
I think you're right that people use gothic when they're not sure what else to call a book. They know they can sort of fall back on that and
right.
Maybe nobody will call him on it.
And particularly with Southerners, I think. I mean, to be Southern is to have gothic tacked onto the end of your name.
So this is set at a school, right?
Right. Yeah, not in any sort of rotting castle or anything like that. No, it's not. It's not a traditional Gothic, but it is Gothic in the sense that it is about the main character struggles, as do Anne's characters, with you know, sort of big hard questions. I mean, evil and good, and serious philosophical dilemmas of it's not blam, you know, fall down, splatter.
It's also
it's
not
that kind of violence.
It's also not Bye Bye Birdie or Grease either.
No,
you know, let's get a little bit more detailed.
You're making
This is not a novel about pep rallies and homecoming queens. It just happens to be set at a school where the smart kids are the ones who have some splaining to do.
Well, I think it's that way in just about every school, actually.
I'm dying to chime in, guys. Are you going to let me chime
in? Yes, absolutely. Anne Rice, hello.
Hi. Let me chime in and say I think that what is so Gothic about Donna Tartt's wonderful novel, The Secret History, is the fact that it deals with the Dionysian souls of her characters. It's set on an American college campus and in that milieu, but it deals with their darker impulses, their timeless attempts to let go to a kind of Dionysian spontaneity, instinctiveness, and sometimes even orgiastic pleasure. That's what makes it Gothic. That's what I think Gothic means to most people. We deal with the dark side, to use the George Lucas cliche. We deal with those things that are not always brought out into the light of day.
Yes,
it's
that's
the spirit. It's the spirit that's real for us. It's the mind. It's the soul. It's the yearning and so forth. It's not whether you went today to school and ate lunch and sat in the corner. It's what you felt when you did it and what you longed for and what you shared with other people. It's dealing with your more destructive but potentially transcendent emotions. How does that sound, Donna?
That sounds good. That sounds excellent.
Well, Anne Rice, let's talk about violin.
Sure.
A ghost story, I guess it would be the shorthand, but certainly there's more to say than that.
Well, I was born in New Orleans, as you know, and I grew up here. And Violin is set in a house on St. Charles Avenue in which I grew up. And I would say that almost anybody would call this house Southern Gothic. It has Greek columns on the front. It is Greek Revival. It's antebellum. It was built before the Civil War. It is haunted in its own right, though I have never seen the ghosts. But in the novel, my heroine, Triana, is in this house, and she's in mourning for somebody who's just died. And this is a woman who loves music, and she hears coming from St. Charles Avenue outside an absolutely exquisite violin. And the violin seems to be playing, especially for her, wonderful wordless songs about the very grief that she's feeling. She looks out the window thinking she's imagining this, and she sees standing clearly in the street, in the light of the street lamp, this young man. We later find out he's Stefan Stefanovich, and he's a ghost, and he's a very powerful ghost. He's tall, he's gaunt, he has long shining hair. He is playing the violin for her, and he looks at her, and they begin a sort of love affair and dialogue that lasts for the rest of the novel. He's come to haunt her because he's attracted to her pain and her grief, but she outsmarts him at one point and snatches this spectral violin right out of his hands. And instead of disintegrating, this violin holds fast for her and enables her, or at least she thinks it does, it enables her to play. She doesn't play like he does. She doesn't play Tchaikovsky or Beethoven or Mozart. She plays a mad kind of bluegrass Gothic music. She plays a wild, extravagant kind of improvised song of her own that really has a lot of Shostakovich in it, a lot of chaos, a lot of order, a lot of rebellion. But anyway, they go on fighting. Stefan wants the violin back. Triana won't give it back. They go back and forth between the spectral world in which he shows her his pain and in which she remembers her own tragedies, all of her life, the losses, things she suffered, and eventually the battle comes to a climax, and we would ruin the book if we said what it was, except that I hope it's cathartic.
One thing that occurs to me, here he is, Stefan Stefanovich. You're writing this about modern-day America. These are contemporary characters, the man who dies in the opening chapters to plunge Triana into a new round of grief, dies of AIDS, a very modern illness. You didn't name the violinist Steve Stevenson, which is after all, what Stefan Stefanovich is.
Well, he would have called himself Stefan Stefanovich. I mean, that's the name he goes by because he died in the 19th century in Vienna, and he was a Russian immigrant. His father was a Russian prince.
But my point is that you make him that, and you choose for him to be one kind of spectral violinist instead of another. And this must be part of the whole craft of evoking mood, of evoking period, and all these other things you want to do.
Right. It's a natural response, however, to loving the music of Beethoven and Mozart, because they did come from Vienna in that period. They are everywhere for sale in the modern world. You can find them in any record store, any CD store, anywhere. And this ghost is true to their era. He knew them. He actually knew them in his real life. And so you might say he personifies a spirit that's very much with us all the time. There are children, people all over the United States and all over the world listening to the music of Beethoven and Mozart. It's for this reason that a lot of the things we do that are called Gothic are no more than realism to us.
Yes, exactly. I mean, your house on St. Charles Avenue, I've seen many houses like that in New Orleans, and to somebody who's never been to New Orleans, they sound Gothic. They sound made up. Nobody really lives in a big haunted mansion with columns, but some people do.
Yes, indeed. And it is really there, and I can drive over to it at any minute and walk through those enormous rooms under 15-foot ceilings, and it was built in the 1850s, and it's definitely there. I mean, the prejudices of realism in American fiction are just that. They're prejudices. Those of us who are accused of writing the Gothic, the bizarre, the macabre, the grotesque, we're really writing about the reality we see. We're writing about the world we see.
Yes, there is. There's a real embarrassment about speaking of certain realities. I mean, there's a very sort of Cartesian reality that's available in both sort of popular film. I mean, there we see death very airbrushed, like in a James Bond movie. I mean, sort of the corpses fall, you know. Those are movies that are products of people who have never experienced death at close hand for people who have never experienced death at close hand. Then, on the other hand, there's what, that's the Hollywood view. And then in, you know, quote-unquote quality fiction, the only way that we really... Basically, that's all about sort of the tasteful epiphany of the soul. I mean, the, you know, sort of the real estate agent has a cup of coffee with his dying mother or something, and a kid comes by trick-or-treating, and he has his little epiphany about death. Now, you can experience death in that way, but our culture is just very, very, very uncomfortable with it. We shove dead bodies. Nobody sees them anymore. I mean, in hospitals, they're whisked away before they're cold. I mean, in the 19th century, and all before, I mean, we were around it. I mean, even in, you know, sort of butcher shops and things, we saw blood more often. And I think this is, you know, why there is such a macabre streak in America, in the American psyche, because there's a tremendous need that's not being fulfilled. This is why, you know, these kind of all these splatter and gore movies. And I think that people long for something that will deal with the reality of death in kind of a moral, an ethical way, a philosophical way. And this is obviously why Anne's books are so, have, you know, touch such a nerve. And, you know, there's such an audience for them, because there's a real need. People don't hear death talked about in these ways, and they need to psychically.
But Donna, when you felt called to write and began to write, were you drawn to this end of the storytelling corridor immediately, or did you do other things first?
Well, you know, it was funny because when I first began to write, I can remember when I was a little girl and looking at my mother's bookcase and seeing, like, you know, all these books from the Book of the Month Club that were about school teachers and people having affairs and sort of movie stars, and thinking, this is horrible. I would feel really sorry for grown-ups. They have to read all this boring stuff. And I was very happy when actually Interview with the Vampire came out. I remember seeing it. It made a big impression on me because... Here's a book for adults which is not about boring things. Now, I knew this was true in, you know, I was reading, it doesn't even have to do with the supernatural. I mean, you know, Huckleberry Finn was very interesting to me. It dealt with sort of realities that I was interested in, and in a deep way.
Look at the grotesque things, the macabre and the bizarre things that happen in Huckleberry Finn.
Exactly, the killing of that pig. That's a very, very grotesque book. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I mix it up with Tom Sawyer, I have to confess, but I mean, remember the house floating down the river?
Absolutely, all those corpses and things. Yes. And it is. It's a very, very scary book.
Jim says that famous line: "Don't go in there, Huck. It's too gashly."
I never forgot that.
He used that as an expression at home to mean something that's really ghastly.
Well, I mean, and you know, if you look at Dickens, I mean, Dickens talks about ghosts all the time. I mean, it was not, you weren't sort of, it was fine to talk about those realities in the 19th century in a way that here it's not always, you know, to be, it's not mainstream if one talks about realities like that. I mean, Dickens, you know, there are lots of ghosts in Dickens novels, but yet one doesn't think of Dickens as a gothic novelist, is what I'm trying to say, or Twain as a gothic novelist. I think it's very good of Anne to have moved us away from, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with sort of this tasteful epiphany fiction. I think it's wonderful, but I think it was very bad for me as a young writer to feel that I had to write that and that nothing was good. And it certainly wasn't, you know, all I wanted to read.
If you're just joining us on the eve of Halloween, we're talking about modern, well, for want of a better term, we'll use a shorthand until we figure out something better to call it, modern gothic novel. And Donna Tartt is with me from the New York Bureau, and Anne Rice from WEZB in New Orleans. Anne Rice's latest book is called Violin. Donna Tartt's the author of The Secret History. Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255. Sean joins us from San Diego. Hiya, Sean.
Hi, how you doing? Good afternoon, Anne and Donna. How are both of you?
Hi.
Fine. How are you doing, Sean?
I'm doing real good out here in California.
Great. Clear weather, sunny skies.
Oh, yeah. 80,
all that jazz.
Perfect. My question was, before I go on, I just have to say to both Anne and Donna, Anne, I have been reading your novels for the last 10 years or so. I am highly influenced by you. And Donna, The Secret History was by far, next to The Witching Hour, one of the best novels I have ever read. My question was, I know that in both of your novels, if not blatantly or subtly, there is a homosexual aspect, and being gay, that really, I really enjoy that. I liked reading about that. It's nice to see in contemporary fiction. What I want to know is, what kind of influences did you have by homosexuals to give you a positive, or at least from what I've gathered from your novels, a positive attitude toward the homosexual persuasion?
Well, I can leap in and answer that first, Donna, if that's okay.
Okay.
The homosexual aesthetic is really our aesthetic. And one of the things we're finding out at the end of the 20th century is that everything that homosexuals have contributed to art is mainstream. The mainstream is now boldly broadening and containing everything that's come down to us. I'm speaking of things like Tchaikovsky was gay, for example, and Michelangelo was gay. And the more we explore art and the more we look into the lives of artists and musicians and writers, the more we realize how much homosexuals have influenced us completely. And there is no real separate gay aesthetic. There really isn't. There is an emphasis, I think, in works by gay people on certain themes. But we all have our emphases. That's what makes us special as writers. I never had anything but a positive view of gay writers and gay artists. I never had anything but a complete love and admiration for the bisexual ideal, the person who can love without the impediment of gender, who can love anybody from the heart based on what he or she receives from the other heart.
I would agree with everything that Anne said, and I would also say that that in order to write and in order to create characters, I mean, I believe it was Virginia Woolf who said this. I mean, you know, one has to be both sexes in a funny way. One has to understand the mind if you're a male writer, if you're a female writer, you have to understand the minds of both men and women, you know, in order to do what you do.
Go ahead, Donna. I'm sorry.
Jumping
up and down here.
I was just going to say, too, that I was very, in The Secret History, I was very annoyed with kind of I think it's a very Hollywood tendency where the gay man is always the murderer, the gay man is always the criminal.
Right.
And I wanted, in a funny way, I mean, Francis, who is the gay character in The Secret History, is far and away the most sane, I think, in many ways of all of them. He's not the scapegoat. And, you know, because that portrayal of gay men was very different from my personal experience, very different from what I knew.
And but if you talk to people about generational differences in the regarding of gay life, you'll find that young people are said to have a totally different attitude from people in previous generations. By setting the book amongst young adults, did you have to sort of absorb that ethic and have it live out in the fiction in a way that if you were writing about 45-year-olds, you might not have had to do?
Well, I mean, I was a young adult when I wrote that book.
No, I understand that, but I mean, it has to be there without saying, I'm here in this chapter, I'm showing you my different young person's take on gender relations and sexual identity.
I mean, obviously you don't want to put it in there like sort of a moral lesson. I mean, for me, it was sort of a chess problem to see if, you know, that, you know, if it was possible to do this without, you know, I wanted to have a gay character in my book that wasn't offensive, do you know, mm-hmm. as many, do you know, it seems, and not a scapegoat. You know, that's not necessarily, you know, it wasn't necessarily programmatic. I don't think it's obvious it wasn't even really an agenda or anything. It was just an idea of a different kind of characterization.
Anne, you were going to say?
Well, I was going to say that I think we've had gay people throughout all walks of life always. But now in the age of mass media, we are seeing for the first time just how many gay people there are of all different kinds. It's mm-hmm. our stereotypes are falling away. In the past, we only saw the more desperate individuals who were willing or driven to be visible. Now we know that all through the culture, are invisibly, there are gay people. There are movie stars like
exactly.
Rock Hudson. There are ballet dancers. There are artists. There are teachers. We know very well that our schools are filled with teachers who are gay, and they do not molest children any more than the
right.
heterosexual teachers do, perhaps less. I don't really know. But that's what's really changed, is the acknowledgement in the last half of the 20th century that that homosexuals exist everywhere, and that,
yeah, you're
that they're not
that
separate from us. It's the same with women. Women have come out of the closet in the 20th century, along with gays. And we really, you know, the person who transcends gender is the ideal, because he will also not, or he or she will not judge other people on the basis of gender. It's not just a question of who you love. It's how you look at other people.
This hour on Talk of the Nation, we're sort of anticipating Halloween by a day, talking to writers who may get the flesh to crawl on the back of your neck just a little bit while you're reading. Anne Rice is with us from New Orleans. Donna Tartt is at the New York Bureau. And this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Sean in San Diego, thanks a lot for your call. We'll go next to Seattle. Hi, Andrea.
Hi there.
Hi, Andrea. This is
Hello.
Anne.
Hi, Anne.
It's Donna.
I'm interested in finding out when Donna's coming out with a new book.
Oh, my Donna signs me to seven
Come
new
on,
contracts.
Donna.
He's not like Anne's. Anne's let her come out with one every year. But
Yeah. Come on, Donna. What's really happening? Where is that manuscript? Come on. I'm going to come up to your house in Mississippi and drag it out of you.
Pretty soon next year. But I'm not kidding. I do work in sort of seven-year increments. That's about how long it took me to write The Secret History, and it looks like this one's going to come in at 7 years, too. If I could work faster, I would. I
mean,
well,
how
I've
old
tried
are you, Donna?
To. I'm 33.
Okay. Well, that means you have about, in actuarial terms, you have about 7 books left.
Oh, wow. Donna.
It's nice to think of it in those terms. Actually, that sounds like a lot. That sounds like an endless
well,
life.
Well, really, that's a
I'll
lot of books.
I'll probably live forever if I have to write 7 books.
But, Andrea, I guess you're going to be standing in the bookstore door whenever that happens?
Standing in line. And I wanted to say something to Anne, too. I grew up in New Orleans, and my mother still sends me all the reviews from the Times-Picayune every time you come out with a book or have a something going on in New Orleans. It seems like you're very active down there.
Yeah.
So I wondered how you split your time between dealing with all of the things going on locally in your writing.
Well, it's a new adventure for me. I'm all involved in the life of New Orleans. I'm preserving buildings, restoring buildings, developing a Café Lestat named after my main character, the Vampire Lestat. I'm writing lyrics for a rock band, Cowboy Mouth, that had its start in New Orleans. I'm doing all kinds of different things. So I don't know yet how it's all going to work out. I work by obsession and by passion and with a sort of overflow of energy. And I storm at the computer and just storm at the keyboard when I'm writing a book like Armand or Pandora or Violin. And then I take off at other periods and do these other things. I haven't got it all modulated, as my relatives would be the first to tell you. You know, I'll be there for 3 days and then vanish for 6 months. But I'm having a lot of fun doing it, and I don't seem able to really control it or contain it. I have to have all these diversions. They're not even diversions. I have to have all these passions.
How do you, in a city like New Orleans, stop yourself from being a 900-pound gorilla, or in effect,
I am a 900-pound gorilla.
Or do you stop
gorilla,
yourself? Really, that's the thing. I mean, when you weigh in on things like development arguments or the design of a prominent restaurant. Or
oh, is that?
Like this.
Oh, I thought you meant the cuisine.
I thought you were going out to Galatoire's too much.
That's what I thought you meant.
Oh no, not at all. Just being cutting more of a figure than maybe all your neighbors are happy with. Let's say.
Well, I think my neighbors are actually extremely happy with the figure I cut. I mean, I could be wrong. They can call in and say if they're not. But there are many people who feel strongly about things, and they don't have the opportunity to speak out. And they're very glad when someone does throw care to the winds and say, look, I'm going to stick my neck out and say your restaurant is hideous, to somebody who built a pink restaurant on St. Charles Avenue that looks completely out of place. But I don't think the public person is a 900-pound gorilla. The public person's fundamentally very different, say, from the conservative and private person who does not want to speak out. But we always need the public person. We need President Clinton. We need Madonna. We need Bill Maher. We need Jim Carrey. We need lots of personalities out there whirling and talking in space, and they speak for many more people than themselves when they do that.
Hold that thought, Donna.
Okay.
Hold that thought. Anne Rice and Donna Tartar with me this hour. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. You can email us at totn@npr.org or reach us by the U.S. mail. Our address here, Talk of the Nation Letters, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C. 20001. At 33 minutes past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research on the development of children, adolescents, and youth, Jennifer and Ted Stanley, and SAP, a better return on information, a global software provider of business application solutions, 800-2831-SAP. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Ray Suarez. Yesterday, at the first U.S.-China summit in 8 years, President Clinton agreed to lift a ban on selling nuclear technology to China.
This agreement is a win, win, win. It serves America's national security, environmental, and economic interests.
We'll talk about the Clinton-Jiang meeting and future U.S.-China relations on the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Ray Suarez. It's the day before Halloween, the eve of All Souls. We're talking to writers who are, well, making new maps for the soul. Anne Rice, her new book is called Violin. She's the author of The Vampire Chronicles and joins us this hour from New Orleans. Donna Tartt, her debut novel is The Secret History. She's at the New York Bureau, and our number, 800-989-8255. Donna, you want to jump back to what you were going to say before the break?
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, Anne is kind of a saint in New Orleans. She does all kinds of, you know, as far as I understand, a lot of historic preservation and things that would be good if people did in New York, actually, or any city.
But it's...
Thank you, Donna.
But often creative people can be anonymous in a place that's so vast, a place like New York, where you find local resentment sometimes, and this is not to say that this... you know, extends to Anne, is when someone who is very well known, very wealthy, or both, moves into a town. In one case, in one memorable case, buys the whole town, or decides to build a casino in a little place.
But
or,
Anne's
you know,
always didn't move there. She's always
no,
like,
no. I understand.
Ray, what are you driving at, my man? What are you driving at? What is the point of all this? I was born in New Orleans. I don't own the whole town. I mean, in the recent dispute with the restaurant owner sued me. I didn't sue him. The judge threw the case out at summary judgment, but I never sued the man. All I said was that his restaurant was hideous. He said a lot of things back to me, and he sued. He sued. The lawsuit cost $17,000.
Oh, no.
And I never sued him. So exactly, I don't exactly understand what you're driving
and
at.
And also,
I think,
yeah, it's not like yeah. some place she's never been before that she's just going to be charged in.
I'm only one of many people in New Orleans. I think there are quite a few people who wield tremendous influence. I piped up, so to speak, about that restaurant, if that's what you're speaking of. But there's no way that I could ever buy all of New Orleans. I'd like to believe I'm one little person with boxing gloves who's got a little bit of a chance to perhaps save an oak tree.
Well, yeah, New Orleans has changed a lot since I was a little girl, and it's I mean, in very, very, very bad ways. And, you know, you just hate to see what's special about a town go. And since I'm not down there, I'm glad you're down there saving those old buildings. It's good.
And the oak trees, too.
Yes, thank you, Ray. Thank you. I appreciate
Indianapolis
that.
Is next. Neil, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Hello, Ann. Hello,
hi.
Donna.
Hi, Neil.
I thoroughly enjoyed The Secret History, and I've really enjoyed reading The Vampire Chronicles by you, Anne. And you were talking earlier about how your characters, or the characters in these novels, seem to feed into a darker nature. And I was curious if you felt that these characters transcended regular morality and immorality and just were sort of amoral.
No, I think my characters are very, very much bound by morals. There is no question. I mean, they're almost obsessed with morality. But morality and convention are two very, very different things. And when you're dealing with an immortal character like the vampire Lestat, you're much more concerned with real morality. What does God want us to do? What is good and evil? How do we manage in a world where we feed on others to live? That is a critical moral question. I will never get away from that in my work because I'm a morality-obsessed person myself. What about you, Donna? How do you feel about that?
Well,
I felt your people were pretty obsessed with morality also, and that they suffered a real crisis when they did anything that violated their own codes.
They were obsessed with morality, but, I mean, actually, one of the characters in Queen of the Damned says, you know, beware of the pure idea, and that's kind of where the characters in The Secret History go wrong, really, is that you can do a lot of things in the name of an abstraction. A lot of evil is committed in the name of an abstract idea that would not be committed in the face of something concrete, something more concrete. I mean, people kill for ideas much more often than they do for personal slights, really.
I think that's really true. And it's we do have to beware of the idea.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Neil, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
I mean, we should be clear, Donna, that your characters aren't jaywalking or speeding.
No, they're
infraction. The infraction that they commit, that they have this crisis over, is they kill somebody.
Absolutely, absolutely. But they are led to do this? I mean, what is evil most often doesn't start out looking like evil. It starts out looking like a lot of fun. Or, you know, Hitler didn't think that what he was doing was bad when he did it. I mean, it was horrible. He was a terrible criminal. But he himself thought he was doing a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
People don't willingly do evil, I don't think. I think they do what they think is good. They think it's right. But
then when the chips were down to cover up for the first killing, they killed somebody else.
But they thought it was right. They thought it was right to do that instead of Henry says, you know, what good is it going to do myself or the general public to spend like 20 years in a Vermont jail? You know, mm-hmm. he actually sort of thinks mm-hmm. about that. He doesn't think that the greater good will be served really by his going to jail. He thinks he's doing the right thing by this second act. I mean, it doesn't pan out that way, but that is what he believes.
Well, that's often the retreat that terribly flawed smarty pants characters take. If you look at Leopold and Loeb, they thought that they were above being, punished for the killing of Bobby Franks. There are a lot of people who say, who then can rationalize about the good of the general public and so on, and that seems to be the fatal flaw that's specifically set aside for a certain kind of person who thinks that they are
most specifically politicians, I think, much more than private citizens. I think that's where we see it most.
Well, I think the fascinating thing about dealing with these ideas in a novel, as Donna did, is that the dilemma of these characters, Henry and the others, it really reflects dilemmas that everybody experiences every day. We all have to ask ourselves, how ruthless will we be to get what we want? And that's true. That's something that plagues us in our love life. It plagues us in our jobs. It plagues us on every level. How ruthless are we willing to be? For example, if I really believed in what God has told me through tradition, through history, through revelation, I would go over and try to do something about the starving people in India. I would spend my whole life like Mother Teresa. But obviously, I've chosen to do a very ruthless thing, and that is stay right here where it's comfortable and write books.
Nick is with us
now. It's not easy.
Nick is with us now from St. Louis. Hiya, Nick.
Hi, Ray. Always enjoy your shows. It's a pleasure to talk with Anne and Donna. Getting back to the Gothic literature question that started this show off, I had a question sort of regarding the roots of Gothic literature, beginning with the original Romantic writers, and how Anne has always been fascinated by her ability to bring some of these classic Gothic myths, the characters, into contemporary times and contemporary terms. And I was wondering if they could talk a little bit about what they see as the Gothic tradition in contemporary terms and whether or not that applies to, say, the visitors that Whitley Strieber describes. Now, I know in his book those are true characters rather than fictional, but it was the only thing I could really think of that sort of a contemporary mythical figure, those aliens.
That's interesting.
It is interesting.
Just how the Gothic tradition has translated into today's society.
Mm-hmm. First thing I'd have to point out is that you can't find anything more Gothic, really, than Macbeth or Hamlet. And they, of course, come way before Gothic literature. I mean,
right. And
think
before that,
about
Dante,
Macbeth.
the divine
yes.
Comedy before that in like 13 something. Yeah, it's old. The Gothic is old. And before that, we have the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of Gothic stuff in the Old Testament.
Exactly. And so I think the tradition that we're in, it really goes all the way back, unbroken, to the Old Testament, to mythology, comes up through Shakespeare, Dante, the Bronte sisters, Charles Dickens, Hawthorne, Poe, right down to the present time. And that is an interesting thing you said about Whitley Strieber and the visitors, because certainly all of the body of information surrounding UFO abductions and UFO visitations is part of our new modern, not mythology, but our, well, what would you call it, our folklore at this point. We don't know if it's true or not. The more I read of UFO abductions, the more I'm hoping it's not true. I was really frightened by Strieber's book, Communion, and am frightened by the research of Dr. Mack. But if you look at this, say, just as something that's happening in the imagination, it is the dark side of the imagination trying to deal with something cropping up that is bothering the rational overlayer of culture. You know, something that's really saying, it's not all what you think. There's really a whole other dimension here to things. There is impending doom.
Yeah, it pops up one way or another. I mean, Dr. Young wrote a very interesting book on flying saucers before he died. He talks about the phenomenon of flying, because people weren't being abducted then. He doesn't talk about that, but he talks about Foo Fighters, and he talks about how these things have started to appear all over, and he basically relates them to certain needs in sort of post-war culture, and it's interesting to read it on that level. And it's also, but Jung being Jung, he doesn't really discount the idea that they could have reality beyond a psychological reality too.
Mm-hmm. I'm scared of them. I don't want them to land in my yard.
Yeah,
I shouldn't even say that. Please don't land in my yard.
Hope they're not listening.
Oh, they definitely listen to this program.
They listen to this program. But, there's several books out that are really bizarre, like The Gods of Eden is one book, and The Dark Gods is another. These are books I picked up over the years that basically say these UFO people, these little grays and these tall mystical UFO visitants, are the same as the fairies and the angels of the
exactly
past,
the little
they
people
want worship.
That are in
yeah.
every country. Yes,
exactly.
The little people,
and that they come from somewhere, but it isn't outer space. It's a part of the earth, or a part of our minds, or another dimension. And they want to frighten us and upset us. And if anything, they want to give birth to religious ideas among us. I don't know. It's a fascinating thing to read about. And
yeah, exactly.
And I
the
have
fairies
but
were always abducting human children. The fairies were great abductors, and
yeah, right.
Very, very, very mischievous. I mean, they did many of the same things that UFO visitors mm-hmm. seem to be
well, they
doing
even look
now.
The same. Which shows you that there might be some archetypical root. The head
mm-hmm.
shape is often the same, the yeah. slight body and those sorts of things.
That's true. That body yeah. shape reappears again and again. That elfin features, little bitty mm-hmm. ears, tricky eyes. Boy, it scares the heck out of me. I'd rather deal with vampires. I know they're fictional and metaphoric.
Nick in St. Louis, thanks a lot for your call. Mara's next in San Diego. Hi, Mara.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good. Hi, Ann. Hi, Donna.
Hi, baby. How are you?
I'm wonderful, and I'm thrilled that I get a chance to talk with both of you. Donna, I thoroughly enjoyed The Secret History, and I am waiting and waiting for the next one.
Oh,
I hope
good.
Next year is it.
I think so. I hope so.
I hope so, too. And I'm an avid fan, and I have a couple of questions. I'm very fortunate, and I get to travel to New Orleans 4 times a year.
Great.
And I have taken the Mayfair Witches Tour, which I had such a great time. And I was in your home not long ago. And
okay.
I love your saints. I was brought up Catholic, and I love the saints throughout your house.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question, though. I was standing outside, and I was taking pictures of your balcony,
mm-hmm.
and I took 3 consecutive pictures. And of the 3, one of them had what appeared to be a ghost
You're
in the
kidding.
Window.
Which which house was it? St. Elizabeth's
the one
or Napoleon?
On
or,
the
oh,
one
the one on First and the one in which I lived, the one
yes.
whence I just came. Yes.
Yes.
And there was a ghost?
Yes, and I've been wanting to send them to you because I belong to the fan club, and I have your address.
It's 1239 First Street.
Yeah, right. And
70130.
I was astonished when I got home and had them developed that 2 of them were very clear. The window was clear. You have the lace curtains.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of them, you can see a vision.
Are you sure, Mara, that it wasn't Anne in her nightgown going to the window to
no.
look out? Because I do sleep right behind those
no.
windows, and I go to them all the time.
You were actually on tour with Servant of the Bones.
Oh, all right.
Stan was there, but this uh-huh. does not look like Stan.
What does it look like, Mara?
It's kind of a foggy, it almost looks like a child.
Oh, my goodness.
Like the apparition of a child.
Oh, my goodness.
And
okay, you have to send me the picture.
I have it, and I want to send it. And that's why I called. I need
okay.
to ask you, would it be okay to send this to you?
Oh, please do.
I was floored, and I walked away with chills. I just thought, oh, I have got to contact Anne. And, in fact, I had tickets for Saturday night, and I'm unable to go.
Oh, you mean this Halloween,
this Saturday.
Halloween weekend?
Yeah, yeah. I'm very disappointed that I can't make it, but I will next year. And I loved your books, and I just finished Violin. I bought it the day it came out, and I always visit the Garden District bookstore and get your books. But
Mira, you've got to send me that picture.
Do
and
you
please
feel,
mark on it, attention Susie Q. Susie's sitting right here with me. She's my assistant, and she'll get that letter and bring it right to me.
Okay, attention Susie Q.
Yeah, Susie Q. But that, I want to see this. I mean, I believe in ghosts, actually. I've never seen one, but I believe in them.
Well, that was my question,
very possible
whether your house was haunted or not. I've shown it to many people, and they're just astounded that it's such a clear apparition.
The house is supposed to be haunted, but it's supposed to be haunted by an elderly woman who lived there for something like, almost 70 years. And I've never heard of a child ghost in my house, but it's entirely possible. I really don't know. If I ever see a ghost, that will be quite a psychic event for me, quite a psychological event. I am open now to seeing them. For years I was closed, but I've now removed the protective light and I've opened my arms to the spirits.
Well,
so
maybe
perhaps it's the beginning.
Maybe that spirit that's already there just had a friend over the day Mara was there. Mara, get the picture to Anne. Cut the suspense already. I'm Ray Suarez. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Charlie's with us now from Washington, D.C. Hi, Charlie. Oh, Charlie.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Charlie.
Hello.
Hello, Charlie. How are you doing?
Good. I just, I read some time ago that the film rights had been sold to a secret, had been sold for a secret history, and I was wondering where that project is in development and thought that maybe Anne may have some pearls of wisdom for you on adaptations.
It's been up and down and around and through. I mean, right now it is with Scott Hicks, who recently did the movie Shine.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful movie, Shine.
Yeah, I'm very happy about that, so I think it's a good match. No, I think it's going to be really good.
So is it in production?
Not that I know of. I think they're still working on the script, but I don't know. I don't have anything to do with the movie-making end of it, and I sort of... really try to stay out of that. I don't know about it because it's just gone through so many different hands. I never know where it is. I went through years of not knowing that, and after about 5 years, I finally sort of lost interest.
Well, does it take on a life of its own truly, or do you have some at least input on script writers and how
the
property's handled?
I mean, not any actual power. I mean, possibly some sort of courtesy listen, but nothing really.
In your books, Anne, that have been optioned either for television, for miniseries, or for the movies, do you write the screenplays yourself, or have you done some and not others? How does that work?
I've done some and not others. I did do the script for Interview with a Vampire, and it did wind up in the film. The film actually, I'd say well over 3/4 of the film, was based on the script that I wrote. And that was a very gratifying experience. But the more you work with people in Hollywood, I think the more you realize that you can talk and talk and talk and consult and consult and consult. And still, when they get together, when they collaborate, anything can happen. Your heart can be broken. They can use half of what you have. They can use nothing. I mean, it's. I think Donna is very wise to just let them go their own way. You can't really have... The only way you can really influence a film is to be the complete producer of that film, like David Geffen was with Interview with the Vampire. And I was very blessed in that David really wanted to make a movie that was true to the book. It doesn't always happen.
It's also difficult. I mean, Nabokov said this, and he was quite right, that, writing a screenplay after you've written a novel is like making a sketch after you've just painted the Sistine Chapel. Do you see what I'm saying? You have to. It's working in a completely different way. And I know that I wouldn't have been able to write a screenplay to... I mean, once you've written something that's so long and complex, it would be very hard. It would have been hard. Maybe I could do it now, but I know I couldn't have done it 7 years ago when I finished, to just sort of boil it down to the bare bones. Now I could, but I couldn't have then.
I think it's very hard to write a script. I don't do it now. What I do like to do is consult and do treatments, sit down and talk about how things should look. What should go on. I think, really, more than ever, I believe this, that the best way to adapt a movie to the screen is to just do the book. I mean, the book to the screen. Do the book. I mean, that's what happened with Rebecca. That's what happens with what happened with Gone with the Wind. It's what happened with Lolita, to a very large extent.
Right.
Just do the book. Otherwise, if you want to do something original on your own, do your own original thing. You know, don't take a book and twist it and change it. Jim Cameron right now is working on The Mummy, one of my more light, rollicking sort of books, and I'm trusting that Jim will do a really great job, but I don't know. You never know what's going to happen. You talk and you hope and you pray.
I have to tell you, Anne, that I was in Luxor last Halloween. I was in Thebes.
Ooh, wow.
Walking among the lowest of the dead. It's Halloween every day there. But it's very funny. I went into the old Egyptology bookshop there. I think it's called Leonard and Lanrock. But it's very old. Been there since the 20s. They have a huge Egyptology section. It's German and French and every language. And the only fiction they had in there was The Mummy, right?
Donna, thank you. Donna, that is almost scary, you know. That is positively scary. But I love hearing that. I've been to Luxor myself, and I absolutely love that part of Egypt. Oh, dear me.
Well, our time is up for this hour. I want to thank everyone who called to join us, and especially thank my guests. Anne Rice, good to talk to you again.
Oh, thank you very much, Ray. And please come down and visit me on Mardi Gras.
Will do. Anne Rice, her new book is called Violin. She's also the author of The Vampire Chronicles and joined us from member station WEZB in New Orleans. Donna Tartt, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Donna Tartt's debut novel is The Secret History. Set your watch. She'll have another one every 7 years. She joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. Talk of the Nation is produced by Ellen Silva and directed by Alana Hadler. The production staff includes Karen Weinberg, Cece Fadupe, and Bipi Gushbegi. Our intern is Devin Robbins. Rich Rary's the technical director, with engineering support from Marty Kersius, Manoli Wetherill, Suzanne Mesnick, Kirill Wheeler, Gary Henderson, and Sue Klein. We had help from librarians Robert Goldstein, Catherine Baer, Ruth Schwer, Alphonse Vinn, and Key Molesky. Pete Michaels is our executive producer. Last week, President Clinton announced the U.S. position on the Global Climate Change Treaty. Join Ira Flatow on the next Talk of the Nation Science Friday for a discussion of the different ways companies can meet tougher emission standards, plus a look at China's environment and its impact on our global environmental future. In Washington, I'm Ray Suarez, NPR News.
This program is a production of National Public Radio. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. NPR is solely responsible for this program. Tapes and transcripts of Talk of the Nation are available. Call anytime, toll-free 1-888-NPR-NEWS. That's toll-free 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Support for NPR comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Bryant College in Smithfield, Rhode Island, expanding the world of opportunity through graduate, undergraduate, and business outreach programs, the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, and the W. Alton Jones Foundation, for a coverage of efforts to reduce threats of nuclear war and proliferation, www.wajones.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.